Do you think that Zelensky wants some sort of political settlement when he calls Donald Trump and talks with him?
I don't know. Desperate men do desperate things. And you got to deal the hand that you're dealt with. I mean, the bottom line is, if Zelensky's still the president of Ukraine, when the next president of the United States is sworn in January, he's going to have to talk to one of them after November. He's going to have to Zelensky's going to have to deal. Adjust to the reality. It isn't going to be Joe Biden. It's either going to be a Kamala Harris presidency or a Donald Trump presidency. That's the reality. So talking to Donald Trump is it's a necessity if you're Zelensky. But remember, it's the actions of a desperate man. This is a man who just literally a month ago was saying there will be no negotiations with the Russians, and now he's saying there have to be negotiations. Why? Because the reality has changed. Russia is not just prevailing on the battlefield, they're dominating on the battlefield. There's nothing Ukraine can do to stop what is happening to them right now. They are in a desperate situation. And if you think about it from Donald Trump, everybody's like, Trump's going to withdraw support to Ukraine. And no, he's not. Please, people, please don't be stupid. Because the withdrawal from Ukraine and all that stuff is it predicated on the war ending. And the war ends only when Donald Trump makes two perfect phone calls. That's his term, perfect phone calls. Because Donald Trump is the ultimate narcissist. Everything he does is perfection. And he will make the perfect phone calls. And he will call Ukraine and say, you must agree to end this war. And now Trump has put out a plan. He'll say, you must give the Russians Crimea. I'm like, well, wait a minute. Russia already has it, but that's okay. But we will get Russia to give you back Zaporizhia, Kherson, Donetsk, and Lugansk. And Zelensky, because that's Zelensky's formula right now. Willing to, he's willing, Crimea, okay, but the others have to come back. They're not talking about the 19, they're not talking about 1991 borders, they're talking about 2022 borders. Okay, so now Zelensky goes, yeah, I'm all in, because he has no choice. He's dying. It's over. But see, Zelensky knows something, that Putin will never accept this. Now, Trump's going to make the second perfect phone call to Putin. And Putin's going to say, pound sand, you orange-faced reptile. No, Russia's never going to give up four territories. Hell, Russia's going for broke on others, I believe. Lavrov said no Russian in Ukraine will live under the Ukrainian the Ukrainian rule, given Ukraine's history of attacking Russians culturally, linguistically, etc. Oh my God, what does that mean? To Odessa, Kharkov, Dnepropetrovsk, Mykolaiv, Sumy, others. Sort of means that Russia is going to take it. And Putin warned. He put a peace plan out there before Zelensky's little magic show in Switzerland. He said, that's the peace plan. It's the best one you're ever going to get. It was a good one. Zelensky said no. And he said, if you turn this down, there will be no more. The next negotiation that's had will be our dictating the terms of unconditional surrender to you. And that's where we're at right now. Russia will end up dictating the terms. Now, Trump, back to his phone call, when Putin tells him to pound sand and hangs up the phone, what's Trump's solution? He will flood Ukraine with weapons. And now you understand why Zelensky is calling Donald Trump. Because that's his goal, to get America to flood him with weapons. He thinks that somehow that will enable Ukraine's survival. Bad news for Zelensky. One, America doesn't have weapons to flood him with. Two, the American political reality won't sustain this. Trump is being elected by a MAGA base that's looking to disentangle America from international conflicts, not double down on stupid. And then three, Ukraine just isn't going to survive. I mean, we got a situation on the battlefield right now. Ukraine has a number of brigades that are pretty good brigades, well trained, well led, well equipped, and they've become sort of fire brigades where Ukraine pulls them out and plugs them in on the line where things happen to stabilize. They counterattack, they stop the Russians. And two of these brigades are the 47th and the 31st, two of Ukraine's better brigades. There's a battle going on right now. The 47th was pulled out of the line, brought up, and supposed to counterattack. as they were getting off the train, two Iskander missiles hit, took out a battalion's worth of infantry, took out a whole bunch of equipment. The 47th is weak. It was brought into the battle. It doesn't have the manpower to do it. They've been pushed aside by the Russians. Totally combat ineffective. The 31st Brigade is now there expecting support from the 47th. They didn't get it. And the Russians have launched an attack that seems to have surrounded one or two battalions of the 31st, pushing the rest back. So the 31st is facing imminent destruction. The 47th has been, that's two of their best brigades. That's what the war in Ukraine looks like today, and it's only going to get worse tomorrow and worse the next day. It can't be reversed. It can't be reversed. There's no manpower to reverse it. Russia has manpower. They're getting stronger. Russia has the equipment. They're getting stronger. General Christopher Cavoli, in speaking to an audience in Europe, you know, it's curious. You got to listen to what he said, because he said, this war will end, and no matter how it ends, we will be facing a strengthened Russian army, a larger Russian army, a well-equipped army, combat-tested army that represents an angry Russia. Did I just describe a defeated Russia? No. I described a victorious Russia. So when Cavoli says this war will end, and either way it ends, what he's saying is we're going to lose. What he's saying is we have lost this war, and we have to adjust to the reality that a victorious Russia with a very large army, capable army, combat-tested army, and an angry Russia is our new reality. Ukraine has lost this war. Everybody knows it. It's just a question of when that dictation of the unconditional terms of surrender will take place. In July and August of 1944, the Soviets launched an operation, Operation Bagration, against the Germans. It's also known as the Destruction of Army Group Center. More than 1 million Germans were wiped off the map. Significant change. That was a strategic defeat of Germany, strategic victory by Russia. Operation Bagration ended in August of 1944. General Krebs didn't sign the unconditional terms of surrender in Berlin until May of 1945. What I'm trying to get at is anybody who says, well, if Russia's winning, why is the war going on? Men die hard. The Germans continued to fight till the bitter end. Krebs signed a surrender document on May 8th. Final terms were agreed to by the Russians on May 9th. That's why they celebrate Victory Day on May 9th. General Steiner commanded more than 1 million Germans in Austria who continued to resist the Soviets in fighting that claimed tens of thousands of lives in those final few days up through May 11th and 12th. The Germans fought hard. The Germans died hard. They were defeated. But the idea that Ukraine's just going to roll over and play dead is wrong. Those two brigades I talked about, the 47th to 31st, they didn't get their reputations by people just writing about them. They earned it on the battlefield. You won't find a Russian officer or a Russian soldier that'll speak ill of those two brigades or many of the other Ukrainian brigades. They recognize the Ukrainians as professional warriors, tough warriors. Hell, they say they're the same as we are because from their perspective, they are the same. Slavics, Slavic people. The Ukrainians will fight hard. They will die hard, but they're going to lose. That's inevitable.
It seems that behind the scene, Europeans are trying to do their best in order to convince Zelensky to continue this conflict. Do you understand what would be the benefits of this type of behavior for Europeans?
I don't think we should say Europeans. I should think we should say a very narrow segment of the political and economic elite of Europe who are currently empowered in leadership positions. But I would be loath to claim they speak for all of Europe. I think much of Europe right now is worried about the economy, worried about immigration, worried about issues such as that. Fact is, many Europeans are tired of this Ukrainian conflict, tired of Ukrainian refugees in their country. You know, they're saying send them home. So I wouldn't say Europeans. I would say this political economic elite who have backed themselves into a political corner because they've invested so much political capital in the notion of sustaining the Ukrainian conflict to achieve the strategic defeat of Russia. They can't back away. If they suddenly say, "Oh, I was wrong. Oops, we just wasted, billions of hundreds of billions of euros of your money, and we've done trillions of dollars of damage to the European economy because of our sanctioning of Russia. Oh, that was a mistake." When politicians start acknowledging mistakes of that magnitude, how much longer do they stay in power in systems that have some sort of democratic representation through the vehicle of an election? No, they get tossed out. So you have politicians right now, in order to remain in power, have to continue to sell Russia as a threat worthy of continued investment in the military enterprise. And that's what we're seeing right now. But the Europeans don't support it, just this political and economic elite, because they have to do this because that's the only way they stay in power. They can't say, "Oops, we made a mistake. It's time to transition to peace." There will be a transition to peace eventually, because Europe, like Ukraine, is destined to lose. But when that transition's made, it'll be made by people who don't share the same surnames as the people who populate the senior political positions in Europe today.
When it comes to the situation between Orban and Fico being cut off from the Russian gas by Ukrainians, do you think that who's behind this type of attitude is Europeans? Or are we talking about Europeans being behind this, or it's the United States just giving the green light to Ukraine to do that?
I think what we're looking at here is a mixture of both, but primarily the Europeans. The European Union seeks to punish Hungary and Slovakia, Orban and Fico, for taking policy positions that are that deviate significantly from the policy position of the rest of the European Union. So this is designed to create economic problems for these two, under the premise that political leaders who can be tainted with the concept of economic hardships, that they're responsible for that, can be pushed out, voted out, removed. The United States, I think, would have a different position on this. One, we are looking at a situation where we are trying to keep Ukraine alive. I don't know the exact, I think it's 60% of Ukraine's electricity comes from Hungary right now. And Hungary said, "We're going to hit the off switch." So, meanwhile, Russia is working with other alternatives, for instance, bringing oil and gas from Turk Stream up through the south, through Bulgaria, into Hungary. And once they get that online, it doesn't matter what the Ukrainians did, but Hungary and Slovakia have said, "We will punish Ukraine for this." And they will punish Ukraine by disconnecting them from their respective electric grids. And that's the death sentence for Ukraine, especially with winter coming, the Russians having destroyed so much of the Ukrainian energy infrastructure. So, Ukraine will be desperate for all the power it can get. And Hungary and Slovakia provide a significant amount of that power. And when they hit the off switch, it's a game set match. Ukraine won't survive the winter. And I don't think the United States supports that. But we have a European Union right now that is angry at Hungary and Slovakia and desperate, desperate right now to be seen by the world as representing a unified face against Russia when the reality is far different.
I don't know if you heard that the Polish Foreign Minister Sikorski is talking about the need to create unbearable conditions for Ukrainians in the EU in order to force them to return home, to send them to the battlefield. This is a country that has half the population it had before this conflict started. And how much more they are willing to put to inflict suffering on Ukraine in order to achieve, I don't know, imagine some imaginary pictures that they have in their mind.
I don't know. They've shown an ability to facilitate a conflict that should have never have started, but once it did start, should have ended in April 2022. But Europe has pushed to continue this conflict because Europe is bought into an American, strategic vision that seeks the strategic defeat of Russia. And Europe now has doubled down on everything on the premise that Russia will be strategically defeated. and so Sikorsky and others, they're part of this political economic elite that may not survive if Ukraine is finally defeated, Russia wins, they will be confronted with the consequences of their policies, et cetera. So they just continue to double down on stupid. They've never cared about the people of Ukraine. Why do you want them to start caring now? How can you claim to care about a people when you've allowed, who knows what the death toll is? Well over 500,000 dead Ukrainian soldiers, probably over 1 million wounded Ukrainians, many of them never to recover. Tens of millions of Ukrainians displaced from their homes, refugees internally and externally, entire generation of Ukrainian children who will never live a normal life because they're either refugees or because their society has been torn asunder. We can just go on and on and on. Europe has never cared about Ukraine. And it's ironic that Sikorsky is the man making this statement, because while Sikorsky is saying that, I believe it was the Polish prime minister that said Ukraine can never even consider entering the European Union until they make amends over Wolin, the Wolin massacre, the slaughter of Poles, over 110,000 Poles by Ukrainian ultranationalists, the same ultranationalists who dominate the Ukrainian government and military today. So there's no love lost between Poland and Ukraine. I think the Polish leadership secretly revel in the destruction that's being dealt to Ukraine. And there's no love lost between Europe and Ukraine. There is no bound. I mean, in what universe does Ukraine say we're not just a member of Europe, but a leading member of Europe? We define Europe. It's only because of the hyper-politicized nature of, trying to justify the support for Ukraine that they've elevated Zelensky into near mythical Churchillian status. And Ukrainian propagandists say the center of the world is around us alone. It's as if Charlemagne never existed. It's as if Napoleon never existed. It's as if Bismarck never existed. We could go on and on and on with great European leaders in history that defined what Europe is today. None of them have a Ukrainian surname. Ukraine is a manufactured state. It's an artificial state. It's a fake state. And Ukrainian nationalism has created this. And now Europe has breathed life into this notion. But at the end of the day, no one in Europe likes Ukraine. Europe is not willing to die for Ukraine. They're willing to let Ukrainians die to the last Ukrainian for a proxy war that isn't about promoting Ukrainian goals and objectives, but using Ukraine to achieve European goals and objectives against Russia. Ukraine is a tool that will be discarded, a tool that they're willing to break, and they are breaking. That's the reality of it. Let's stop pretending that Europeans care about Ukrainians. They don't. Right now, in every brothel in Europe, there are Ukrainian women there that the European men enjoy sexually exploiting. That's the reality of it. Ukrainian women will feed the brothels of Europe for decades, whether they leave Ukraine because there is no economic future for them, or they've been kicked out of Ukraine as this permanent refugee class that will never get their feet on the ground. That's the reality of it. And if you don't acknowledge that reality, then you're blind.
Dmitry Peskov is talking about that Trump represents the US political elite, all of which suffer from Russophobia. They think that Trump wouldn't bring any sort of difference to the conflict between Russia and the United States. On the part of the Americans, in your opinion, what would that bring in terms of the relationship between Russia and the United States? Is Trump capable of bringing some sort of improvements to this relationship?
No, Trump is incapable of bringing improvements to this relationship. But Trump doesn't represent anything. He doesn't represent the American political elite. He is the opposite of that. But all of America has been infected with Russophobia. And Russia has given up on trying to cure it. I mean, 2 years ago when I met with Anatoly Antonov, that was one of his main concerns. He's the Russian ambassador to the United States. Main concern, how to overcome Russophobia. When I saw him last month, it's not even on his lips. Russia doesn't care. Russia's given up. America is to be isolated. Russia's moved forward with BRICS. And that's the harsh reality, the sad reality. Russia, while they're not promoting war with America, they seek to avoid conflict with America. Russia stopped being concerned about what America thinks. They're not trying to win Americans over. They've given up on that. Russia's focus now, Russia's no longer talking about being a partner to the West. Russia's talking about its new status as a Eurasian nation and its pivot to Eurasia. That's the focus. Last time I checked, neither the United States nor Europe were part of Eurasia. Russia is.